You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 6th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Coming up on today's programme...
Well, thank you very much. They call it Super Tuesday for a reason. This is a big one.
Donald Trump all but secures the Republican nomination on Super Tuesday. ASEAN members finish their meeting in disagreement over how to tackle China's maritime incursions. Plus, we'll hear from the chairman of the Munich Security Conference.
We have... of course, always the history, German history, you know, influencing our behavior. But when you look at the polls, you see gradually a change.
And we'll learn about this year's winner of the Pritzker Architecture Prize. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Vincent McAvinney. President Joe Biden and Donald Trump have swept the state primaries held on Super Tuesday, setting up an almost certain rematch between the two candidates in November. Nikki Haley did manage to win her first state, Vermont, but it's being reported she's soon to drop out of the race. In a moment, we'll hear from Simon Marks in Washington, D.C. But first, let's hear from Monocle contributor H.J. Mai, who attended a viewing party in Northern Virginia.
It's about 7:30 p.m. when I arrived in Arlington, Virginia. On this evening, the affluent D.C. suburb is playing host to an election watch party, organized by the local Republican Party. Gathering spot is O'Sullivan's Irish Pub. Instead of showing college basketball games, on this night, the TVs in the bar are tuned to the election coverage from CNN, Fox News, and even MSNBC. Matthew Hurt, who's the chairman of the Arlington Republican Party, seems satisfied with the turnout.
We've got about 100 Republicans from across Arlington who are here, who are excited about watching the results come in to see who we're going to nominate to defeat Joe Biden in November.
A quick scan of the room reveals a crowd that includes a wide range of ages, genders, and ethnicities. I spot some red MAGA hats, men wearing suits, and women in cocktail dresses. But there are also plenty of people dressed casually, sipping on their beers and engaging in conversations. One of them is Trevor Benson.
I've been with Trump probably since day one. What kind of won me over with Trump was when he first took the stage in 2015, and he was very critical of the Republican Party establishment on foreign policy and on the conflict in Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan. And he was honestly the only Republican on the stage who was actually criticizing them for their involvement in these countries.
And now, almost 9 years later, his support for Trump is stronger than ever. With Trump closing in on winning his third Republican presidential nomination in a row, Trevor and Matthew are closely watching the results as they come in state by state. Next on their agenda is convincing those who didn't vote for Trump to join their ranks.
At this point in the process, Donald Trump is going to be our nominee, and so I'm interested in talking to moderates, to independents, to even to Democrats who maybe voted for Nikki Haley. And I want to say, you're welcome in this party, you're welcome to support our principles, and we want to move forward to November to defeat Joe Biden.
For Monocle, I'm H.J. Mai in Arlington, Virginia.
Well, I'm joined now for more by Washington reporter Simon Marks. Simon, thank you for joining us. Firstly, how certain are you now that this is a Trump versus Biden rematch?
Well, I think we are 99.999% recurring certain, Vincent, and that very last vestige of doubt will be paid in under 3 hours' time, because we know that Nikki Haley has scheduled an appearance at 10 o'clock in the morning, Eastern time here in the United States. That's 3 o'clock in the afternoon, GMT, at which she is going to drop out of the presidential race. She's stared defeat in the face in all but one of the Super Tuesday contests. She eked out a victory in a very close-fought race with Donald Trump in Vermont, but otherwise did not win a single state, and so she's decided to throw in the towel. But what we do not yet know is whether she is going to endorse Donald Trump. She's been hedging on that issue over the last few weeks, whether she's going to pledge her support for the man who will now undoubtedly be the Republican Party's presidential nominee and will spend now the next 8 months engaged in a general election rematch with Joe Biden, who, of course, on the Democratic side of the aisle, also swept the board last night.
If Nikki Haley's campaign was a traditional one, it would have long been over. But she decided to stick to the race, perhaps thinking, you know, Donald Trump might become entangled legally with his impending court cases and he might have to drop out. But what do you think went wrong for her? Why couldn't she sort of manage to beat him in a couple more states, given all the problems that occurred during his first term?
Well, I think, first of all, because by the time she engaged in this process, it was pretty late and there were a number of other rivals already out there, including Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who had spent months campaigning before Nikki Haley officially declared herself as being interested in the race for the Republican Party's nomination. Also because, of course, Donald Trump has this dominance over the party, as Ron DeSantis found. I mean, this sort of unshakable grip with his own supporters absolutely cemented in place, and now evidence in opinion polls that he's pulling supporters away from Joe Biden. In the weekend poll that was published by the New York Times, we saw that 10% of Joe Biden's voters in 2020 now said they were going to vote for Donald Trump. But most of all, I think, because she just never really found a voice that was sufficiently compelling, despite the many warnings that she was proffering Republican voters about the dire risk of choosing Donald Trump again and the threat to democracy that she says he represents. And of course, that presents a difficulty for her now in deciding what to do next, because it'd be very hard for her immediately to endorse Donald Trump, having said all the awful things she's been saying about him on the campaign trail. On the flip side of the coin, Donald Trump has to find a way of reaching out to her voters. He's got to find a way of persuading the never-Trump wing of the Republican Party that over the eight months that lie ahead, some of them really need to come over to his side. He's got to win them over if he's going to become increasingly secure of his position and possibly secure in the outcome of the election and delivering a Trump victory.
And how has Trump reacted? And do you think that sort of never Trump, Nikki Haley branch are minded to just sit this one out? Or do you think those people will be going for Joe Biden on the day?
Well, I think it's a little too early to say. I mean, 81% of voters in North Carolina in exit polls yesterday who backed Nikki Haley in that state's primary said they would not vote for Trump in November. And there's no question that in places like Northern Virginia, as we just heard, in city suburbs with a higher degree of college-educated Republicans, Nikki Haley scored reasonably well, although not as well as she was hoping to do in Northern Virginia itself. We've definitely seen movement over the last several months by some of the Never Trumpers into Donald Trump's column. And now he's got 8 months to prove that he is worthy of their support. But there's also a risk in that, of course, because even in his speech last night, Donald Trump thanked everybody, said he was amazed by the outcome of Super Tuesday, but then went into a very dark riff about America being a third world country. He even at one point raised fresh questions about the sanctity of its electoral system. So the danger for Donald Trump is always in the sort of the unforced error, given that he enjoys riffing on the campaign trail over 8 months. There's a strong possibility that he's going to say as much to alienate Never Trump supporters as he might to bring them across the aisle.
And Simon, just briefly, what happens now? Will Biden, now that he knows clearly who his opponent is, effectively launch his own re-election campaign? And when is Trump next in court?
Yes, well, it's unbelievable that it's only March the 6th, but the general election campaign starts today. I mean, that's absolutely clear. The remaining primaries will continue to take place, of course, but they now become irrelevant because we know who the two candidates are going to be. So we're in for that 8-month slog. As for Donald Trump's court dates, we don't know exactly when he's next going to be in court. He was supposed to be going on trial in May in connection with the federal case of the alleged mishandling of classified documents. It's even the prosecution concedes that's not going to happen. They want the trial now to begin in July. Trump's lawyers are going to argue it should be delayed until after the presidential election. The federal case on voter interference is delayed as the Supreme Court considers Donald Trump's immunity claim, and the Georgia case about election interference has also run into the long grass because of the Fulton County's district attorney's concession that she was engaged in an affair with one of the prosecutors. That's led to its own separate legal process. The only case that looks like it's going to come to trial anytime soon is the one in New York over the hush money payments made to adult film actress Stormy Daniels. And that's the one where Donald Trump is least at risk, frankly, of being jailed if he's convicted, or of losing much support over the substance of the trial.
Simon Marks, thank you. Now here's Carlos Arribello with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Vincent. Palestinian militant group Hamas says it is pushing ahead with ceasefire talks in Cairo, despite the lack of Israeli negotiators present. Talks are ongoing with Qatar and Egypt. The US has also now backed an immediate ceasefire in the United Nations Security Council. France and Moldova have said they will sign a defense pact on Thursday. Moldova, located just west of Ukraine, has long feared Russian incursions and destabilization. The West has been seeking to strengthen Moldova's military capabilities. And the UK's MI5 intelligence agency has lowered its threat level in Northern Ireland from severe to substantial. The threat level was raised last year after a series of attacks on police officers ahead of the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Vincent.
Thank you, Carlotta. To Melbourne now, where a summit of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations is wrapping up. Philippines President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. has warned fellow members they must work together to defend maritime laws and territorial integrity from China's increasing threats. Joining me now is Richard Haydarian, academic and columnist for the Philippine Daily Inquirer. Richard, thank you for joining us. Firstly, what were the main topics discussed at this meeting?
Yeah, it was a, you know, broad-ranging kind of meeting between Australia and ASEAN. Of course, there's huge trade and investment ties between the two sides. Australia is a near neighbor of Southeast Asia, after all. It has tremendous amount of investments in Vietnam, Malaysia, and many countries in the region. And also, the two sides have a lot of shared interests on major geopolitical concerns, whether it's the conflict in the Middle East, it's things that concern China's aggressive behavior in adjacent waters, not to mention also moving, you know, talking about humanitarian issues, counter-piracy, terrorism. So it's really a broad-ranging and very comprehensive relationship. And I think in that sense, Australia can feel good about hosting this event because it did emphasize how central ASEAN is to Australia's foreign policy, especially Albanese's foreign policy. But also Prime Minister Albanese was also able to present himself as a kind of a global leader who can gather almost everyone from a very vital region and gather them in Melbourne and show that the two are lockstep in terms of trying to chart a better future for the region.
And when it comes to the South China Sea, what did the discussions focus on?
Well, I mean, that's where things get quite interesting. So just before the summit, the president of the Philippines, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., gave an impassioned speech before the Australian Parliament, where he presented the Philippines as a frontline state, reminded of the two countries' long history, including their World War II camaraderie against imperialist Japan, and essentially implying that, you know, once again, we are having a kind of a rising aggressive power in Asia, and that the Philippines, Australia, and other like-minded democracies should work together, and that he's not going to make any compromise, even a single inch of Philippine claims in the South China Sea amid growing tensions with China. But my problem is, you know, I was there at the inaugural Australia-ASEAN summit 6 years ago, 2018, in Sydney. And back then, Duterte was a no-show. And Duterte, a pro-Beijing Filipino president, Completely snubbed the West, refused to visit any Western capital. This time around, my fear is the Philippines went in the completely opposite direction, that the Philippines ended up as kind of an outlier, overinvested in this Australian-ASEAN summit, hoping to gather really as much support as possible in its own struggle against China. But if you look at the final statement that came out, I was going through it again a while ago, and there's the usual stuff, generically calling on all parties to exercise self-restraint, but there's no calling out of what China has been doing, including what China did just yesterday. China has been water cannoning Philippine resupply missions in the area within the Philippines exclusive economic zone. There have been very violent incidents and even potential of small skirmishes, if not conflict, between China and some of its neighbors because of its aggressive behavior and expansionist claims. And yet China was not even named or called out by any of ASEAN countries. To make matters worse, the Malaysian Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim seemed to be more busy bashing the West over the conflict in Gaza and supposed double standard of the West over the conflict in the Middle East than calling out China and its own atrocious treatment of its own Muslim minorities. Not to mention, he openly said that what we're seeing is xenophobia and that Malaysia has no problem with China, even if Malaysia has been at the receiving end of China's coercive activities in the South China Sea, where also Malaysia has claims. Not to mention, a few years ago, there was a political explosion in Malaysia over, among other things, China's dodgy investments, its so-called debt trap strategy in Malaysia. So this is what's sad for us in the Philippines, that we are getting more support from the West, countries half a world away, like the United States or countries like Britain, not to mention Australia, than some of our own immediate neighbors who seem to be lawyering for China.
And why do you think they're so reluctant? Is it out of fear?
Well, obviously it's a combination of greed and fear and interest, right? In terms of greed, China is a huge investor in a lot of these countries. And I think China has done a good job of overselling, its commercial diplomacy in the region. I always say the Chinese get more bang out of imaginary buck because they also pledged billions of investment in the Philippines. Not much really came in terms of it, but they're good in that. They always say, if you're good with us, we'll make major investments. But I think some of the especially Muslim majority countries in the region, because of their strong feelings about America's policies in the Middle East, particularly in Gaza and Palestine, and because China has taken up the cudgels or supposedly taken up the cudgels for Palestine, they're developing this kind of a peculiar situation whereby they're almost turning a blind eye to all of the adverse strategies or policies of China and zeroing in all of their criticism on the West. And then, of course, there's domestic politics. There's domestic politics in a lot of these countries and in a lot of these countries in the region. They rather side with China because, China is a good patron. If you want to win out in contested elections, if you want to have a patron when you're facing problems in your own country. In fact, in the Philippines, former President Duterte is still counting on support of China when he is in big disagreements with the current president, Ferdinand Marcos Jr. So it's greed, it's interest, it's domestic politics. But yes, you're right. There's also an element of fear. Because China is an immediate neighbor, and China, when they don't get their way, they don't only throw diplomatic tantrum, they retaliate. They retaliate through tariffs, they retaliate as they did to Australia before, they retaliate through trade sanctions, they retaliate through withdrawing support, and sometimes they retaliate through coercive military actions. But to be honest, for me, Southeast Asian countries, although they're smaller than China, surely, a lot of them are actually not small countries. You're talking about 300 million people in Indonesia, almost more than 100 million Philippines and Vietnam. So we're mid-sized countries. So I think if we have the right mindset and strategies, we can have a mutually beneficial relationship with China that is also self-respecting and also draws the line when it comes to our core interests. But it looks like some of our neighbors are more interested in bashing the West or implying that the Philippines is the agent provocateur than actually expressing solidarity and standing up to China's aggressive behavior. So I think that was the more disappointing thing about the ASEAN summit as far as the Philippine perspective is concerned. But I think in overall, there was nothing out of the blue. There was nothing controversial with what came out. And as far as economic and investment relationship, people-to-people relationship with Australia and ASEAN is concerned, I think everything is really on a positive trajectory. So in that sense, it was a successful summit.
Richard Haydarian, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You're back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio. As Super Tuesday looks set to confirm former President Donald Trump as the Republican candidate for 2024, allies in Europe are being forced to think hard about their defense commitments. And also, as we've heard on this show, Germany's Chancellor Olaf Scholz's attitudes towards supplying military aid to Ukraine has been singled out for supposedly not doing enough. Andrew Müller spoke to German diplomat and chairman of the Munich Security Conference, Ambassador Christoph Heusgen. He began by asking the ambassador if he agrees that Europe should be taking better ownership of its own defense.
We are further than we have ever been since 1989. I think that everybody has understood that there is a, as we call it in Germany, now Zeitenwende. We realize that things were going in the wrong direction in 2014. You may remember we had the annexation of Crimea. We had the Wales-NATO summit. Everybody committed to 2%. But then afterwards, there was again complacency setting in and no real effort then actually happened. But this has changed since February 22nd of 22. I think people are much more serious here. And the, when you look at the polling in the US, I think this has a new sense of urgency. So I think people are more serious. Are they serious enough? We have to see. But definitely, things have changed.
As you will know, Germany in particular has been criticized over the last 2 years for not taking this seriously enough, for all of Chancellor Scholz's discussion of this this change in mentality that you alluded to. Is it still fair, do you think, that Germany is criticized for, as I think as a lot of European countries see it, kind of hiding behind its own history and using that as a reason not to step up as a serious military power?
There is no clear-cut answer. Number one, when it comes to support of Ukraine, Germany is number two on military, on economic aid, financial aid. Look at the number of refugees we have taken on board. So there is a lot happening. Also, when you look at defense spending, for the first time in basically three decades, we are reaching this year 2%. So something is changing. Are we there yet? No, we are not. There is still a change of mentality that has to arrive with everybody, with all parties. There is still this reluctance. There is still, with some politicians and in parts of the population, that somehow, you know, we can go on as we have been going on for, you know, basically 70 years of the Germany's existence.
Does that apply as well, do you think, in terms of how Germany addresses the conflict in the Middle East? Again, for very obvious reasons, Germany has always been a bit squeamish about criticizing Israel. It abstained on the UN General Assembly vote for a ceasefire in Gaza in December, which 153 countries backed. Does Germany need to get past its history in that regard and be able to have straightforward conversations with Israel?
I'm just wondering how Britain voted. I don't think that they voted much different from Germany. So this is not an isolated position. But
indeed,
yes, you're not. Right.
Indeed not.
You see? So it's not a singular position. We have, of course, always the history, German history, you know, influencing our behavior. But when you look at the polls, you see gradually a change. And I can describe it perhaps a bit like this. Former Chancellor Merkel said, you know, it's the raison d'être is for Germany is that Israel's security is a question of our, you know, the basic fundament of foreign policy when it comes to the Middle East. But there is some changing now. The people seeing the violation of international humanitarian law, seeing the horrible situation in Gaza. So when you look at the polls, there is some change. And more people are saying, well, if we say that the security of Israel is of our utmost, has utmost priority for us, is, you know, in the long term, Israel's security really best achieved by allowing Israel to do everything that the present government is doing, you know, including arming of settlers and then pushing out settlers in the West Bank, and all what is happening in terms of violation of international humanitarian law, 30,000. Is this really in the security interest of Israel? And they're more questioning, but so far the position in the General Assembly has been as you have described.
Just finally, then, I'd like to try and conclude on something at least slightly positive, which was an idea which I know was doing the rounds at Munich about reviving the Weimar Triangle, this being the arrangement between Germany, France and Poland. Is that an acknowledgement, do you think, perhaps an overdue one, that Poland really is Europe's coming power?
Well, we have, when you go back in history, the Weimar Triangle, since reunification, has always been high on the agenda of German politics. It was just very, very difficult to implement that during years where the PiS, where Kaczynski's were in power. Now with Tusk back, it's still, they have some domestic problems, but I'm sure that the Weimar Triangle will become again very important, maybe even more important than in the past, because the role of Poland, of course, is very important, and even more important now that we have the security challenge in the East. Yes, absolutely. I think that we'll see a revival, and a revival which I think is very important for the integration of Europe. If I may say one more thing, also with regard to your country, I see also the tendency now to overcome, a bit the very bad mood that was on the continent and also in Great Britain after Brexit. I also see a certain normalization of relations coming there, which I think we need to achieve when we see the challenges that we face. And I think we are much better off if Germany and Britain work closer together than it has been after Brexit. So two silver linings there.
That was Ambassador Christoph Heusgen speaking with Andrew Müller. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Finally on today's show, Japanese architect Raiken Yamamoto has been named the winner of this year's Pritzker Architecture Prize. He is the 53rd recipient and the 9th laureate from Japan. He was honoured for his buildings that aim to foster community. I'm joined now on the line by Tim Abrahams, contributing editor to The Architectural Record. Tim, thank you for joining us. Firstly, were you surprised that he was this year's winner at all?
I was surprised, I will admit it. I also admit I didn't immediately know who he was. But then fortunately, I realised I knew his work, and then I was very pleasantly surprised.
And can you tell us about his work for people that might not know of him?
Well, the thing that brought me to him was the building I know him most for is the Zhanhai complex in Beijing, which is this incredible mix of residential and commercial in the heart of Beijing. It was built in 2004 in a very early moment in the urbanisation of the city. And it's this incredible blend of urbanity and community, commerce and homes. It looks very austere. It's very gridded and regular. There are several towers all looking the same. But at the ground level and within the buildings, this is an incredible way in which, in a city that was rapidly changing, different groups of people are brought into contact with each other. People seeking food are able to eat late. Young people living in the towers above, a mix of ages and a really positive, optimistic moment for architecture. And I realized I knew him, and it was proved to me that it's always wise to go for a beer late at night in a city you don't know.
And why do you think he was chosen as this year's winner?
The surprising reason is because of the way in which he is able to foster community and in buildings which aren't small, vast buildings. Some of his later work is incredibly large. He did two huge university campuses in Japan in 1999 and 2000. And they're vast structures. They're unprepossessing in their appearance. They're steel and glass and concrete. But the way in which Yamamoto breaks them up and introduces different communities to different others through the use of space, through the revealing of what he's very strong and very clever use of glass, which isn't something very fashionable at the moment, but something that he's an expert with, because he understands the theatrical way in which we look before we use a place, the way we are guided through a building. He's very clever and very useful architect to study.
And if anyone listening wants to check out one of his buildings, which would you recommend most?
Oh, the Hiroshima Nishi Fire Station, which was done in 2000. It's this really clever architecture intelligence. It shows you what it's like to be a fireman. They've opened up the community to it. There's shared public space on the fourth floor. You can go in and watch the fire station in operation. They have an amazing kind of glass displays which you can look into and see the kind of very life. And it's become this kind of very strong public building in an unprepossessing site.
Tim Abrahams, thank you. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Chris Chermak. Our researcher was Neoma Ekwe. And our studio manager was Steph Chungu. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Goodbye, and thank you for listening.